Hi, this is Damien O'Doherty. We're here on Center Maryland's The Lobby podcast, and we have the greatest of all time edition today, our first one ever, because we have the greatest of all time. He's Senator Frank Kelly. Welcome, Senator Kelly.
Thank you, Damien.
I understand it is a beautiful day in your neighborhood because you have a major celebration going on at this moment.
Yes. Today, Jant and I celebrate our 61st wedding anniversary.
6 decades together plus one.
Yes.
I read the book Surrender to Win, which is the memoir of Senator Frank Kelly. And there was a great chapter in there about when you all met. You were at Villanova University at the time.
Correct.
So you couldn't have been too old. How old?
I was, when I met Janet, I was probably 19. I was 21 when we got married. She was 20. Yeah, I married her 2 months after I graduated from Villanova.
Do you remember the feeling you had when you first saw your bride across the room? Is that how it?
Yeah, well, it was, to me, love at first sight, because my plan was to just play the field forever. I was having too much fun. And all of a sudden, I went up with a friend of mine who was engaged to this girl, and they were having this mixer at Glen and Mercy. He asked me to ride up with him. So I go up there, I have no, plans. I walk in, I meet this beautiful woman, and she's the president of school, she's president of council, she's running this whole affair, and she just, more than physically beautiful, she was just beautiful inside, and I immediately was attracted
to
her. She
had like a presence.
Yeah. So after the mixer, I got to figure out how to get close to this lady, right? So she had a big broom. She was sweeping the floor. I said, give me that. I'll sweep the floor.
And that's a good move.
So I swept the floor. She said, it's the last time I ever swept the floor. And then I decided to take her out. So we had a group of guys at Villanova. We were party guys. Called us the 12 Apostles. And we'd sit around every Thursday morning in the pie shop, which was the coffee shop at Villanova. And we'd all decide who we were going to ask out, because none of us want to be turned around. So if I'm going to ask Mary, then nobody's going to call Mary.
Okay.
And if Joe's going to ask Sally, nobody's going to call Sally.
That's different than we handled it at Mount St. Joe. It was a little more competitive. I'm sorry, you guys were smart enough to
We avoided the fights. It wasn't good for the girls, because they didn't have any choice, right, once somebody picked them. So I said, I'm calling Janet Kelly. Who's she? I explained. Most of them didn't know her. So we had that was Thursday. It was always Thursday night we'd call for the dates, and then we'd go to a party Saturday. I call her Thursday night. I said, Janet, it's Frank Kelly. How you doing? I said, man, I love meeting you, and I just love to take you out. She said, oh, that's nice, yes. I said, how about Saturday night? I said, want to go out Saturday night? She said, I already have something Saturday night. This was Thursday night. I said, you do? That's not the way we worked, right? And she, I said, well, maybe we'll try it again. She said, oh, yeah, I'd love to do it. I'd love to go out, but you got to give me more notice. So I waited 2 weeks. I was shot down. I had to face my friends. I got shot down.
The pie shop, right.
And these guys, they never had a problem with 2 days' notice with the people they were calling, right? But Janet was a little bit above. She was high class.
Didn't want to be hustled into some situation.
Yeah, and she was going with some guy by the name of Joe Finnegan, who was that I didn't know she had a boyfriend, Finnegan. All right. So I called her 2 weeks later, Thursday night again, for Saturday night. I said, you can't be busy. She said, I am. You got to give me more notice. And she turned me down twice. So
I'm learning about this calendar thing the hard way.
Yeah, I'm a three-strike and you're out deal, right? So we decided to have a mixer on Easter Monday, our fraternity, a mixer.
The 12 apostles.
So I figure I'll call her Thursday night for Monday. There's no way she's got something on Easter Monday night, right? So I call her, and I said, we're having this big party Monday night. Would you like to come? She said, oh, yeah. She said, I think I'm okay that night. I said, well, I would hope so. Monday night. Who'd hope, If you said no to me now, baby. But then she says, I have to ask my parents.
Uh-huh.
I'm going, oh, wow.
Yeah, well, this put-together lady came from somewhere, right?
Oh, yeah. She had to get permission. So we went out that night, and I spilled a pitcher of beer in her lap after, like, 10 minutes with her. The second date, I spilled an orange freeze on her. We were at a Howard Johnson's after. It was wild.
So she's wearing an apron now. On the
oh, yeah, my
date.
God. So she endured all sorts of. And for me, I realized this lady was really special.
Yeah, did you think at that age you already viewed her as a partner? Because you have a unique partnership relationship. You know, you both have very different strengths. And you complement each other. You complement each other almost as much as partners as husband and wife. Talk to me about that a little bit.
Yeah.
Where did that come from? That sounds like it came in pretty early. She was an equal partner right out of the gate.
Oh, yeah, we were meant for each other. She's smarter than me. She's a natural leader. All of our kids are leaders, natural leaders.
What were you missing, you think, that she had that filled you up a little bit, even at that young age?
I think she built up my confidence, and she had a cultural presence that I didn't have. And I came out of a family, great family. My father was a recovering alcoholic, but right. I went through all that drinking stage with him. And her family was very stable, and mine was somewhat stable. But, you know, we just, I can't even explain it. She gave me confidence that I could be successful in whatever it did. And whatever I did, she would support. She supported everything. And it's funny. We started this business years ago in the basement of our home, the two of us, in 1976. We didn't have 2 cents to rub together. Only moved to Maryland from Philadelphia, from the Villanova area in 67. So this is like 8 years later, we're starting our own business.
You're in like Hockeysville.
And she's down in the basement helping me. We couldn't have done it without her. So it's funny, last year we celebrated our 60th, and my sons had a big reception for us in our office building in Sparks. We have a pretty good sized lobby, and all the employees were invited. So after they made all the speeches and everything, my son Frank said, "Dad, do you want to say anything?" I said, "Yeah, sure." So I get up and I thank everybody for being there, and you know, thank God for the Kelly Benefits business that he's blessed us with, and I say all the formalities and everything. And then I said, you know, I said, Janet here, when we were dating together, I told him a story about the two no's and the yes. I went through the story. So I said, this guy Finnegan was her boyfriend, and I always kidded her whenever we drove through Chester, Pennsylvania, where Finnegan came from, which is not, you know, a blue blood area of Pennsylvania.
Right.
And I'd say, see that, the kids in the back car, I said, see that? That's Chester, Pennsylvania. That's where Joe Finnegan lives. He has a hoagie shop over there in Chester. He's running a hoagie shop, right?
Could have been Finnegan Benefits, right?
So I'm telling everybody about this guy, Finnegan, and Janet gets up and she said, thank you very much. It's really great to be here. She says all these nice things. And she says, I just want to correct my husband on one point. If he hadn't married me, this would be Finnegan and Associates. People went nuts.
That's awesome. And true.
And true. And true. Finnegan. Yeah, and then she, the best part, the best, people tell me the best chapter in my book is the one about Janet.
Yeah, I agree. I think when you talk about sort of growing up in your household and things being, for example, maybe a little less stable than the house your wife grew up in, then you are a dad with many children. You got a new business. How did you know how to be a dad? Your dad was a great dad. Could you model himself there, or could you take a little bit of your dad and then add a little of Janet's dad? Or how did you come to be the dad of dads?
The biggest turning point in my life was my dad was an alcoholic who recovered. He died very young at age 47, but he was sober 3 years. So I had experienced alcoholism in my house, and I knew it was in the family. And then I worked my way all through college, worked hard in a job, but I was a party guy. When I went to, I'd love to drink. I swore I'd never let happen to me what happened to my father.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget the first drink I ever had was a 7-7. It made me feel different.
Uh-huh.
And gave me less anxiety and so on. So I didn't. I was age 30, and I didn't like who I was.
Yeah.
I was like 29. I knew there was something wrong, but long story short.
You were doing great. I mean, you had a great job and
good
all
job.
That, right?
I never
well-liked.
No accidents, no DWIs, any of that. A lot of my friends didn't think I had a problem, but I knew. And I just didn't like who I was, and I got some good help and advice, and this one doctor said, why don't you go to AA? So I went to AA, and the first time I went, I couldn't relate. And then, this is interesting, I read this book called A New Primer on Alcoholism. It's written by a woman by the name of Marty Mann. This was back in the late 30s, early 40s. And she said, if you have any questions on whether you have an alcohol problem or not, because the AA definition is if your life has become unmanageable to any degree, in any way, through the use of alcohol, you got a problem. And so she said, there's a test you can take. You got to take at least one drink of alcohol every day for 90 days, no more than three. And if you can do that, so I went like 29 days.
Wow.
And then on the 30th day, I go to a party, and I had like 14 drinks.
Right.
And I kept this book. It's in my book. Of all the drinks I would take.
Right.
And I'm saying, 14 drinks, went to a party, got in a fight with Janet or something like
that. Journaling. So,
I failed the test. I didn't make 1 month.
Yeah.
So that was kind of
that's a cool test.
Yeah, it's a good test, and you know, because people...
And the journaling's key, the writing it down, even if it's just a notation.
And they say in AA, there's many and varied. Now, I can break my anonymity, but, you know, which I've done, and did it in my book. But I learned, the title of my book is Surrender to Win. And the first three steps of AA, and these are the 12 steps of AA. Anybody who works is going to have a successful life. I'm not talking about monetarily, but you're going to be doing what God wants you to do, pretty much. First, admit you have a problem, you're powerless over. Second, admit there's a power greater than yourself, which is God. And third, you surrender your life and your will to that power as you understand them.
Right.
So that step, it took me about 4 years to understand it, because everything we're taught in this world and human nature is, I got to be the toughest, the smartest, the best. And I learned that spiritual principles are the exact opposite of human principles.
Yeah, it feels a little like walking off a diving board sometimes.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, and then, you know, I was at a meeting once, and they were talking about surrender to win, or yeah, you got to surrender. And I thought about the, if you look at all the parking lots where the ships come into Baltimore, this was back in 1970, when I quit drinking, this was like 1970 and 72 in that area. And all you saw were Toyotas and Mercedes, Japanese and German cars. They lost the war. They surrendered. And look at them. They won. They won. Right? And I'm thinking, well, there's there's a human example of what God's trying to tell me.
Yeah.
But the spiritual principle is if you surrender and trust in God, and once you do that, it's hard to explain, but then it doesn't mean you have any problems. You have problems every day and challenges. But you learn to turn things over to God and surrender them. Yeah. It takes a tremendous burden off your shoulders. That's why I named the book Surrender to Win. So that kind of got me. It's a long answer to your question. Prepared me to be a good father by working those 12 steps of AA. And then I became, then I ended up, you know, my AA never tells you it's Jesus Christ or Judas, but a higher power, power greater than yourself. I found it in Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Personally, after I got out. And I was always raised, a Catholic my whole life.
So, Janet, AA, and what else? Those are those filled in the mold of how to be a dad.
I looked at my life as a pyramid, and that established the base.
He talks in pyramids. This is why we get along. We talk in pyramids, too. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah? So... You know, if you have a strong base, that's how a pyramid stays up, right?
Yeah.
And the broader the bottom, that's what holds it. So I looked at my life as a principle. My base was my faith in God, my trust in God, my willingness not to drink alcohol anymore, anything that would keep me from that relationship. And
you have an amazing relationship with your kids. They describe you as a young kid. They say,
"Yeah, I'm the biggest kid in the neighborhood."
My dad is like being with the biggest kid in the neighborhood.
Yeah,
and you know, I have alcohol has intersected with my life in all kinds of silly and terrible ways. And I just notice a lack of screen or film between you and your kids. I feel like with me and my kids, I bet you there's a little bit of a film there or a screen or something because of alcohol or what have you, you know?
I don't know. I mean, I never judge another person.
I always love that about you, how you, like, I remember I tell people when I was 26, we came out here golfing. It was a big Dutch Rupertsberger golf tournament or something. And I had a big night the night before. And, you know, after golfing with you, I didn't feel guilty about putting you through 18 holes with the most hungover guy in Ocean City. And I should have. I always feel guilty about everything. And I walked out of there not feeling guilty. And I walked out of there feeling like, you know, this alcohol stuff's not solving problems for sure. It's not helping. So I just and the idea that you could have a conversation about it or be a part of someone's life in that way and them not judge you is an incredible feeling. It gives you a feeling, even if it's on a golf course or with you an event, gives me a feeling like you got a safe house for me.
Yeah,
you know,
everybody's that's another thing I've learned. I don't judge other people. I observe and I watch, and I'm there to help. If anybody asks for help and anything I can do to help, I'm going to do it. I don't force it. I don't force my beliefs on anybody.
What's the deal with all your achievements? I'm just going to, like, rattle off a couple of them, which is, you know, the baseball stadiums in Camden Yards and the creation of the Stadium Authority and getting through all the different budget crises, creating the University of Maryland medical system from next to nothing into a multi-billion-dollar healer. You know, to me, that's a lifetime of achievement. Did you set out and say, hey, I want to achieve these things, or I need to make my mark with the built environment or the policy environment? Do these things just happen upon you because you're a lovely guy? Like, how do you amass? And you really got to read the book to get a sense of just everything you can think of in the 80s and 90s in the government space, Senator Frank Kelly was at the center of, and a pivotal center. After that, you dedicated it all to philanthropy and business and family, but which has its own achievements.
Yeah.
Do they just happen? It's just the residue of incredibly hard work? Is it just wanting to be in the game? Like, how does that all come through your toll, your stop?
It's a really good question. I can say this. I didn't plan anything. Some people are great. I believe in strategic plans if you run a business. But my plan was to stay away from the first drink one day at a time. My plan was trust in God and show up.
Show up.
Trust in God and show up. No matter how bad things feel or bleak or how you feel, if you're supposed to be somewhere and that's your responsibility, you show up. And it's amazing when you show up, the things that happen. So I got elected to the Senate in 1979 and happened to be there in the 80s when all these opportunities presented themselves. I happened to be in a leadership position on the Senate Budget Committee. And as a result, if when you're on the Budget Committee, you usually get involved in this kind of stuff.
That's right.
So
follow the money there.
I can't say that I planned it, but I can say this with the stadium, that was Governor Schaefer deserves the most credit for that. We lost the Colts left, and everybody in Baltimore remembered it, was alive at the time. I'll never forget the day I woke up, BAL radio at 6:30 in the morning, the moving trucks were taking the Orioles out of, Colts, the Baltimore Colts out of town in Indianapolis.
I'll never forget it either.
So Schaefer, so this was in everybody's mind and heart, and this was maybe 20
I'll
years
tell you
later.
What, Senator, real quick, just on that, I think of some of us in this business do what we do because the Colts left. I feel like when we went out and got the banner, I feel like that's that hometown spirit. So I didn't mean to rear up.
Well, you know, it was a blow to Baltimore and to the spirit. And Schaefer never forgot it. So Schaefer was governor, and Edward Bennett Williams was the owner of the Orioles.
Biggest trial lawyer in America at the time.
Phenomenal trial lawyer, and a good owner, a really good owner. And he realized that the old stadium wasn't going to work. The economics weren't going to work. The Orioles really needed a new stadium to play. So Schaefer introduced legislation they did a study and they found a location downtown, which is now Camden Yards. There was another location I looked up at the Beltway. It was out in 695 and Wilkins, or towards 695 and 95. And that area was one spot. But Schaefer wanted it downtown. He was the Baltimore mayor and he loved downtown. He wanted the stadium downtown. So long, there was a lot of opposition to it. The Washington area folks didn't want it,
right,
because they favored the Washington teams. They didn't want any more competition. But they were pretty good about it, to be honest with you. But the question was, how are you going to pay for it? So we had to figure out, and I told the governor, I said, I'm not going to vote for anything that's going to raise taxes or cause, you know, we got to figure out a way to pay for it. So we came up with the idea, we set up a stadium authority, and the governor appoints the members of the authority. We give them bonding authority to issue bonds, so they can issue bonds to pay for the stadium and keep it going. And how do we fund it? We decide we fund it through a sports lottery. So there was no general taxpayer help.
So it was all the scratch-off tickets?
Yeah, it was special lotteries. So that was the way
you could show your kind of hometown team spirit,
right,
by buying the lottery ticket.
That was the way to finance it. But the one story, I think it's, I put it in my book, that we didn't have the votes on either side. And I suggested to Alan Rifkin, who was Governor Schaefer's lobbyist, I said, we got to try to get Edward Bennett Williams here. Edward Bennett Williams is one of the finest trial lawyers in the country and well known for the way he handled himself in court and had represented some very difficult cases. Why don't we get Edward Bennett Williams here? So that's a great idea. So he goes back to Schaefer, tells Schaefer. Schaefer announces that Edward Bennett Williams is going to come. And we hadn't even planned it. Actually, we have a joint meeting, House and Senate. Long story short.
So the owner of the Oilers.
Yeah, and he reads about it. Nobody even talked about it. We got through that. We worked it out. I'll never forget the day he came. We were in a joint hearing room, which is a semicircular room. We had members of the House and the Senate sitting there. And he had been suffering from cancer, was going through treatments, and had to take a nap in the governor's mansion before the hearing. We delayed it 3 hours for him. 5 o'clock, we'd schedule it. Senate and House Appropriations, Senate Budget and Tax. He comes in alone with Alan Rifkin, sits down, puts his briefcase next to him at the table, takes this magazine out of the briefcase, and then slowly, never says a word for like 10 minutes, dead silent, and goes around the room, shows to everybody in the audience. It was a picture of the three Rifkins, Cal Sr., Cal Jr., and Billy. And that was a time when Sr. was the manager, and Cal and Billy were star players for the Orioles. And he said, you want to know what the Orioles mean to Baltimore? He said, this magazine is on the front, on newsstands throughout the world. So everybody in the world now knows about Baltimore that wouldn't if you didn't have the Orioles. So that's the case for why you got to keep the Orioles here. And the other reason is we can't operate in the current environment economically. We really need a new stadium.
Right.
We got to move ahead. He did such a good job. Between that and the idea of the stadium authority, we were able to get it done, and the history is what you see now at Camden Yards.
So the policy ended up being as strong and fortified as the architecture of that building itself.
And it showed the example of people working together. Today, I think idealism on both sides prevents people from coming together. You got to be pragmatic, and you've got to listen to the other side. So if you want to promote your side, you better understand the other side,
yeah,
and respect it.
That's right.
So you try to understand the other side and respect it, and that's how you get it done, solve problems. You bring people together. But I mean, we even had people from Montgomery County and Prince George's who initially didn't want it, supported the stadium in the final analysis. The story is another fascinating story because we had the University of Maryland Medical Center downtown Baltimore, and it was part of College Park, University of Maryland system.
Right.
Before we had a system, it was University of Maryland College Park. And the medical school was at UMB, University of Maryland, Baltimore,
right,
in Baltimore City. And the hospital was located there. And it was losing money every year. It was really bad. And they would come back to the legislature for deficiency appropriations every year. And we finally get, this is it. We're not gonna fund it anymore. You got to get control of that place. Maybe we ought to think about privatizing it. And that was an idea that came out in the hearing. Long story short, we got together with the Board of Regents. We drafted legislation that privatized the University of Maryland Medical System. And then Shock Trauma, which was another program I was very, very involved in with R.M.'s Cali, who found it, was the only successful part of the medical center. Callie didn't want to be part of it.
Huh.
He said, I want you to kill the bill. So I had the ability to kill the bill. But after I thought about it a while, when I say the ability, I had the votes to kill it if right. I wanted. And I've lost my train of thought here. I figured out, after I thought about it, I called R.A. one day. I said, R.A., I'm putting you in the bill. I said, shock trauma needs to be part of something bigger. You have too much uncompensated care. Patients, you get patients that you don't recruit.
Right,
they
right.
come here,
right.
you fix them, yep. you, 97% of them you save, and somebody's got to pay for it because a lot of them, over a third of them at that time couldn't pay.
Right.
So I said, you got to be part of something bigger. So I'm putting you in the bill. And he was all whacked, mad, didn't talk to me for 6 months. And I said, don't worry, I'll protect you. I'm going to make sure as a member of the Senate or the House on that board to look out. So, and I made sure I got appointed. So we privatized the system, and then I got appointed to the board, which was then the University of Mellon Medical Center, not system.
Right.
And I was on there to protect shock trauma. And I saved on there for 45 years. And then right. over the years, we ended up acquiring other hospitals.
Right.
And then we became a system.
Yeah.
And so it's like 13 hospitals, $5.5 billion, and we serve, serves 25% of the state population. That all came out of a failed enterprise. And the relationship with the School of Medicine got improved over the years. And those early years, it was terrible.
They had to surrender to win.
Yeah, there's a good point.
Right?
Yeah.
Right?
So I was really blessed to not only be... It's really neat to be part of writing something that creates something and then being part of the implementation of
right,
it.
And then walking around the halls of it.
Yeah, know? And then living it. Yeah, that's yeah, how I've yeah, lived yeah. it. Same with shock trauma. You know, I helped Callie.
Thank you for shock trauma. You got me through there one time. My car accident outside of Annapolis, and Barbara Hoffman called up and said, we got one of our staff guys coming in,
wow,
and they took care
yeah.
of me like you wouldn't believe. So thank you.
Oh, well, yeah, thank Dutch. So my buddy Dutch Rippensberger.
You created this guy too, the Dutch Rippensberger.
Dutch and I ran against each other in 79. And he had been saved in an accident just like you. But he was DOD on the road. Some doctor pulled up to the accident scene. He said, put him in a body bag. He's,
wow.
He's done.
Wow.
Meanwhile, the trooper on the scene was a guy by the name of Scott Sewell. He calls for a helicopter. So as the doctor is making his comments, the helicopter lands. And Trooper Sewell said, load him up and send him down to shock trauma. So he gets on a helicopter. They're taking him to shock trauma. And they say, we got a DOA coming, possible DOA. So they tell him what to do to stabilize him. He gets down there, and he's still breathing. And so he was in a coma for, like, I think 10 or 11 days and then came out of it. And, of course, Dutch is Dutch. He's perfect today. But he always talked about he wouldn't be here without shock trauma. So we're campaigned against each other. And one night after a debate, we go out to Howard Johnson. It was up in Carroll County. And, it was Pizza Hut. Yeah. I said, Dutch, I don't know who's going to win this race, but I tell you what, if I win, I promise you I'll look out for shock trauma. I didn't know anything about shock trauma then. I won. I beat him. And the first person I had in my office was Don Ashworth and R. Adams Callie, who was a tough bear, man, to meet. And I talked to Callie almost every day for 12 years.
Wow.
Helped him get the helicopters, the new building, and all that. Little did I know what I was getting into, right? And then
the
over
rest
that
of
same
your life.
So that same period of time, we get Dutch on the county council, get him. He's county executive. Now he's in Congress. So
that's a Diallaggio right there. That's moving it all around to put everybody in the right place. You know,
the other lesson there is now I'm out of office.
Yeah.
I've gotten as much or more done out of office as I did in office.
I tell people that.
Yeah.
I tell former elected officials that all the time. I tell them your story.
Just like
because it's
politics.
Much and can be much more fulfilling and can give you more flexibility.
If I have a message to elected officials, I'm trying to, you know, it's not, you know, you get so many people kissing your butt all these years.
Yes.
You can't help but be affected by it.
That's right.
You know, you got to get look back.
Could you imagine dealing with somebody as smarmy as me all the time? You know, it's just, you know, they deserve
better. I dealt with you, man.
Last question. You are a statesman of the state of Maryland for its 400-year history. I'm telling you that. You're going to deny it, but you are one of Maryland's great statesmen, statespeople. An interesting wrinkle to that is that you are also the creator or progenitor to, like, one of the largest lacrosse families in the history of the game, and I'd just like you to chat a little bit about the power of lacrosse and athleticism and how that's all worked with your family.
Well, you know, I guess I worked my way through college, but I did play football, baseball. I swam and I rode crew for 3 years in high school. Once I got to college, I couldn't play sports because I had to pay for my tuition. I worked. I wasn't that good enough, I don't think, for Division I, but I was a fair athlete. I think Janice always been a good athlete, but never exhibited it. Her parents got it kind of protective, but every one of my sons turned out to be better than average athletes.
And businessman.
And same with business. And that's the other thing. I don't micromanage them. You know, I support them. And what I learned as a parent, you find out what your kids are interested in, and if it's worthwhile interest, you support it. Unless it's a rabbit trail, you don't want gum down. But you support whatever
it
do. So Frank got involved in lacrosse. I always coached him in baseball, Little League, and I coached him and everything. And Frank got involved, and he went to Calvert Hall and had a great career there. And his brother John did, following him, David, Brian. They all played Division One. David and Brian won national championships at Carolina. Frank played pro ball. He went to Cornell. John played until his eyes went bad. He's got Best disease, which is a retinal disease that his mother now has too, or has had, and he couldn't see the ball anymore. So he went to cycling. He's got this big cycling race coming up this weekend in Baltimore. And so they just turned out to be really good players. And then now I have 21 grandchildren.
And they are playing at the most elite schools, lacrosse schools in the country, right?
Yeah,
Denver.
Right now I have one at Denver, one at Maryland, one at Georgetown. I think they're all possible Final Four teams. Maryland are always there. Georgetown has a really good shot. And then I have J.K. just enrolled in Cornell. He's a defenseman.
Big red.
But I had
almost did it last year.
The thrill of my life was in 2016. I had three of my grandchildren on the Carolina team. And I had Stephen, Patrick, who's now a medical doctor, and Timmy. And Patrick was captain of the team. We go to Final Four, and we beat Loyola in the semis, and then we play Maryland in the final. Now, I am on the Board of Regents for the University of Maryland. I got three kids on the Carolina team playing against Maryland. And before all this started, over the years, Joe Bressy, who's the coach at Carolina, I said, Joe, if you guys ever get to the Final Four, I'd love to be on the sidelines. Because my son Brian is the head coach at Calvert Hall, always with him on the sidelines. And I learned not to yell
at
the refs.
It's a famous picture about this.
Yeah, it was all over TV. So sure enough, they get to the Final Four, and Bressy gets via tagged me on the sidelines. So I am on the sidelines. It's for the national championship. Carolina's losing by 2 goals. And I'm on the sidelines and I'm praying. And it was Patrick's last game, and I'm saying, Lord, please help Patrick. If we don't win, I want to win, but if we don't, please help Patrick to do good, to go out in style. Patrick, who rarely made mistakes, throws a ball across the field over the guy's head, and the ball goes out of bounds. He runs off the field quickly. The long stick comes on, defender stops Maryland. They get the ball back. Patrick gets it, passes it to attackman. Most unbelievable assist I've ever seen. The guy scores. We're down one. Stephen Kelly, who's a faceoff guy, wins the next faceoff. He gets it to him. They move it around. Patrick scores the tying goal. And it goes into overtime. I'm going, thank you, Lord, right? And then we get into overtime, and I see they put Timmy. Timmy was a freshman. They put Timmy on the field. So I had three Kellys on the field, and we won the national championship.
Incredible. And it's a beautiful photo, too.
Yeah, it was. And
little Carolina blue for the statesman, but.
Now, though, we got Daniel Kelly at Maryland. Maryland had a great team last year. We finally got one at Maryland. Daniel's a good one. He stays healthy. He'll take Wisnowski's spot, although Wisnowski was a great player. Very almost impossible to replace him, but he'll probably fill his spot. And hopefully, if he can do half as well as Wisnowski, we'll be thrilled.
Well, if we could just get Senator Frank Kelly to write a column for the Baltimore Banner about college lacrosse, we'd all be winning.
God
Thank
bless you.
Surrender to win.
God bless
Senator
you.
Frank Kelly, thank you for everything.